This is The View from 22 from The Spectator. Subscribe from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk.
Welcome to The View from 22. I'm Sebastian Payne. In this week's episode, we'll be looking at the state of the election with 1 week to go, Boris Johnson's vision for the future of conservatism, and whether it will become illegal to criticise some religions if Ed Miliband wins. I'm delighted to be joined by Times columnist Tim Montgomery, Ryan Bourne from the IEA, Fraser Nelson, James Forsyth and Douglas Murray. And now on to our first topic, which is naturally the general election, with just 1 week to go until polling day. In the magazine this week, James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson have interviewed Boris Johnson out in the campaign trail at Uxbridge, who seems to be in an ubilant mood despite if David Cameron wins or doesn't win. So, James Forsyth, to begin, how is it good for Boris if David Cameron wins and if he doesn't win?
Well, Boris does seem convinced that the Tories will win. He's running around telling everyone this election's going to have a happy ending. It's going to be like 1992. But I think that whatever happens, Boris Johnson's star is going to continue to rise. If David Cameron wins, Boris, I think, will probably be Prime Minister in about 2 years' time, in that I think Cameron won't stick around long after the European referendum. And Boris will be the natural person to take over. Whereas if Cameron loses, Boris will become, I suspect, will be the favourite in the Tory leadership contest that will follow the election, because Cameron won't stick around to be leader of the opposition. And so, you know, Boris is going to continue to rise whatever happens. I think personally, I think he wants Cameron to win partly because he's a Conservative, but also because it's a lot quicker for him to get to number 10 if Cameron wins than the other way around. And I think also, 5 years of being leader of the opposition, the danger for Boris is that the joke begins to wear thin. I think it's probably better for him to go straight into Downing Street as quickly as possible.
Fraser, one of the things you asked of Boris was if he was still editing The Spectator and he was writing the leader column, which this week endorses the Conservative Party for the upcoming election, what was his response to how he would write the leader this week?
Well, he gave this wonderful tour de force of all the reasons why one should vote Conservative. If you want a Britain where enterprise matters, if you want where industry and thrift are important, if you want a Britain where tall poppies are not chopped down, but instead all the poppies are nurtured, then vote Conservative. That was a rather different point for Boris, the one about all the poppies being nurtured. This is his new theme of inequality mattering, that conservatism is about making sure that all the flowers in the flower bed are watered, or to use his analogy he used, that if you're going to have rich guys drinking Chateau Margaux in first class, you must also make sure the economy class people are given G&Ts all round throughout the journey. The Conservatives, as he said, are the party which makes sure the passengers in economy class have enough gin and tonics to keep them happy. I don't know if you can call that G&T conservatism, but that appears to be the new Boris agenda.
So it's clear, James, because one of the things that we'll talk about later in this podcast is that the Conservative Party certainly is lacking vision in terms of what the overall theme is. And it seems Boris has painted out what his vision would be as leader of the Tory party here.
Well, I think hearing Boris dictate a leader off the cuff as a journalist is a rather depressing experience, because you realise that he could kind of effortlessly produce copy that most of us would have to spend quite a while slaving over. But I think what you see is that there is this big philosophical debate in the Tory party, which is, you know, does the gap matter? Or is it just the condition of the low paid that matters, or is it the gap between them and the top? Boris says the gap matters. I think he's also got a very good argument, which is undoubtedly a free market argument, which is true, which at the moment the state is subsidising low pay, and I really do not see any reason why the state should help corporations pay people less than the wage that you need to live on. I think Gordon Brown created tax credits, and he has created a monster.
And that is going to be a massive problem for whoever wins the next election. I mean, the tax credits, Britain is now one of the few countries in the developed world where the government is actively subsidising low wages. And there's a rather awkward question about how you resolve this. Do you stop the subsidies and thereby make people poorer? Or do you order companies to increase the pay? And I get a bit depressed about the debate about minimum wage, because let's remember, only about 2 or 3% of the public take minimum wage. The problem is for the bottom 10%, their pay in real term is not much better than it was when John Major left power in 97. Now, the minimum wage hasn't helped the bottom 10%. I think we've got some really fascinating, interesting and difficult questions to address after this election. Questions that have been put on the table by this election campaign. And tackling the problem of low pay is going to be one of them. That will involve a solution to tax credits, but it's going to involve a solution far wider than the simple issue of minimum wage.
I think it's also going to require a kind of return to what I think Boris is getting at, which I think has a kind of will strike a chord of a lot of people, which is a kind of decency, which is if you're a company director or boss, if you're going to pay yourself £1 million, make sure that you're at least paying your cleaner a relatively reasonable wage. I mean, this is one of the things that people want. There is a sense at the moment that there are, first of all, too many rewards for failure in business, and secondly, that people are paying themselves amounts of money that are unseemly when you're driving down wages at the very for your very lowest paid staff in your organisation.
I know Boris did that when we met him, James. He was, you know, talking almost with the Ed Miliband style concern about these big bosses who earn squillions and pay their staff little. But let's remember that most job creation in Britain is done by the small businesses, not big businesses. And no, the
small businesses aren't paying themselves squillions. Although they can't, they're certainly not.
Sure, but it
rewards.
Doesn't really. But you know, the problem of low pay, I think, is a lot wider than big companies.
I know. I think that's true. But it is particularly egregious in the case of big companies that could afford to pay more who choose not.
Yeah, but it's also significant that Boris pointed to that differential, isn't it? Because you know, five or 10 years ago, the Conservatives would have said, "We don't care how much the guys at the top are earning. Our only concern is that the people at the bottom are doing better," because inequality greatly widened under Thatcher. But the Conservatives thought, well, that doesn't matter because those at the bottom are doing a lot better as well. So if the guys at the top are moving even faster, that's the price you pay for progress at the bottom.
But what's interesting about what Boris said as well was he's worried about this for political reasons as well as philosophical reasons. He basically said that the wealth gap in London, the sheer size of it, is one of the reasons why the Tories are struggling in London at this election. And I think when you go back and talk to people who fought elections in the 1980s. In those times, you know, that what you might call kind of entrepreneurs, they all thought they were on the same side. You know, the bankers who were benefiting from the big bang in the city, to the guy running a newsagent's, they thought they were on the same entrepreneurial side. They don't anymore. And I think that's partly because of the financial crisis, but it's also because the gap has got so big. And I think if you're going to have the acceptance of low taxation of income and assets, people have to have a sense that they could kick on, that they could earn more money, that they could join this gilded elite at some point.
And I wonder if Boris is becoming this sort of voice of progressive conservatism because he is the mayor of London, and in this city these problems are simply more visible, they're more acute than they are in the rest of the country.
I think one of the fascinating things, and something that Seb's work has touched on recently, is the way in which devolution is changing British politics, because you are seeing in Ruth Davidson a different kind of conservatism emerge, one that can survive in the harsh climb for conservatism of Scotland. Boris, you're seeing a conservatism emerge that can survive in London, a city where almost half the population is non-white and where you have these huge differentials in wealth between the richest and the poorest. So actually, the devolution of power is creating different forms of conservatism in really quite fascinating ways.
So are we becoming a bit like American, James? You know, with the Republicans, they've got their governor who do various states.
I know. I think we are beginning to see this, that different models of conservatism will come to Westminster. You know, I think it is no coincidence that there is a kind of axis between, when Ruth Davidson was asked the other day about all Tories being posh, and she cited Sajid Javid and then Stephen Crabb, who's the Welsh Secretary, comes from a council state, as examples of non-posh Tories. I think you are beginning to see kind of a kind of different kind of regions producing different kinds of conservatism.
And then just finally onto the state of the campaign at the moment. Obviously, we've been following this with our daily podcast, but the cover of this week's magazine is everyone struggling to get towards the finish line here. Fraser, at this point, a week off before polling day, do you want to readjust anything that your hunch, your funny bone tells you about what's going to happen?
I still think it's too close to call. I still think we're in a situation where 500 votes here or there could make a fundamental difference to the outcome of the election. Unlike the American presidential election, I don't think Britain's is predictable by polls, not at the moment. That said, the movement in the last week has been towards the Conservatives rather than towards the Labour Party. It's, you know, and insofar as one's spidey sense is worth anything in elections, I don't think it's worth much. But my spidey sense tells me that things are broadly going Cameron's way, that his focus on the economy is beginning to have some resonance, that the attack on the Labour SNP alliance is beginning to have some cut through. And I think his tax stunts, you know, where he promised not to raise taxes, has underlined a wider truth that the Conservatives will be the only party to keep the cost of government down.
And James, this week we've got the final TV appearances, interviews with each of the leaders, with David Cameron, Ed Miliband and Nick Clegg going in front of a Question Time audience. And what can we expect from that? Do you think it'll make any difference?
Well, I think this is the big question is, you know, David Cameron's public performances have improved. His stump speech has got better. You know, ever since The Spectator asked him the passion question, he's injected a bit more passion.
This is like in the last 10 days of a 5-year parliamentary term, but better late than never.
And I mean, the question, if Cameron can bring that new improved performance to the Question Time point, this could give him some more momentum. Also, Labour love these events because they say that, you know, it's the unmediated Ed Miliband. The thing I would say, which is Ed Miliband's achievement, which is the bar for him is far higher than it was than the first of these TV things, the Jeremy Paxman, Kay Burley thing, where basically not falling over was a Miliband achievement. I think by Thursday, things are more difficult for him. I also think that Nick Clegg, you know, I think Nick Clegg has fought a very good campaign, but the British public just haven't been listening to what he says. Does that change on Thursday night? I wonder. I also think the BBC have a potential nightmare on their hands because this royal baby hasn't yet been born, and what happens if it is born in some of this hour and a half period? Are they going to inform the audience? Are they going to inform the nation?
What happens if it's born at like exactly 10 o'clock when the polls close? That will be, forget your exit poll, we're going to be on baby mode for the next 4 hours.
We're given something to do before the first sets of results come. So I think it is all very, very difficult to predict at the moment. But I just sense, talking to people in the various camps and out in marginal seats, the Tories are feeling the most bullish they've been feeling at any point in the campaign.
That isn't saying much.
I think that's right. I was going to say, I don't think the campaign so far, I don't think the in some ways, when you talk to Labour people, the campaign has exceeded their expectations in that they are still standing. I think even some of those very close to Miliband thought that it was going to be, that they were going to get mowed down. Someone said to me on Friday, in a phrase that stuck in my mind, we're still here, in a very pumped up way. Whereas for the Tories, the expectations were obviously higher. I think the Tories are beginning to think that this last 10-day shift that they have been praying for, it is starting to happen. Now, I don't think we've seen enough evidence to conclude it definitely is, but there are some kind of early little signs that might be occurring.
And now on to the future of conservatism and what is going to be the most important thing for the next generation of conservative politicians. In the magazine this week, Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth have interviewed Boris Johnson, who talks about inequality as the big challenge. Tim Montgomery, in your project The Good Right, you've looked at this big question of what's the next thing for conservatism, and you tend to agree with Boris that inequality is the thing that needs to be tackled. Do you think David Cameron has misstepped here?
I think inequality is certainly one of the things that the Conservative Party needs to tackle. The key issue, though, is we don't know what's going to happen in the general election. David Cameron may lose, he may win, but winning will be crawling over the line and just about surviving. Something has gone wrong with conservatism. We've had a whole range of Thatcherite era policies put before the electorate in this general election campaign, from right to buy to a lock on taxes, no higher taxes. But somehow voters aren't persuaded. And I think part of the explanation is that people don't see the Conservatives as on their side. Ordinary voters don't see Conservatives as on their side. They see the Conservatives as a party of the rich. Part of that may be inequality, but it's generally a lack of solidarity that people think the Conservative Party has with them.
Because Ryan Bourne, traditionally, the idea was behind conservatism is that everyone gets rich, then that's good for society. But as Boris says in the magazine, he sort of feels as if there's something gone wrong there. Do you think he's right?
Well, I think Tim may well be right on the sophology behind all of this. What I would question, actually, is whether Boris actually means it. I mean, looking back to 2012, he gave a very, very different speech about inequality to the Centre for Policy Studies. I suspect that part of this actually is about sort of what James Bartholomew described in one of your recent articles as virtue signalling. You know, in polite company now you have to sort of claim that inequality is a great ill in society in order to position yourself for a prominent position like leadership of the Conservative Party. But I do still think, underlying all of this, most Conservatives do authentically believe in enriching the absolute condition of the working class and not the gap between rich and poor.
And do you think this is virtue signalling, Tim, from Boris?
I think it's a deeper problem than that. I think actually inequality is a much greater problem than even the left recognises. There's a fantastic new book out from Robert Putnam called Our Kids, and he talks about how some children are growing up with almost no social infrastructure around them, that they have very few reliable, stable relationships in their lives. This is echoing something that Charles Murray wrote in his book a few years ago called Losing Ground. And yes, there are economic factors at work here. There are crony relations between a lot of big business and government that means not only are the poor not getting richer, the rich aren't getting poorer. Government is putting a safety net under the very rich, and they aren't being held to consequences for their mistakes. And what I think is needed is a thorough examination of why so many people do not have the social capital as well as the economic capital to succeed in life. And if Conservatives can't comment on the lack of social capital, then we're not Conservatives at all.
I think Tim's right to a certain extent. Obviously, there's an obsessive focus with the left on, paradoxically, on material inequality, income inequality, wealth inequality. But ultimately, I still don't think you're concerned with inequality, Tim. I think that if I gave you a magic wand and said, you know, if you wanted to equalise life expectancy by lowering the life expectancy of people in Kensington, you wouldn't choose to do it because you're a good person. You recognise that actually some people living longer is better than nobody living longer. Having said that, I do agree with Tim that there's certainly a section of society which doesn't have that sort of social capital, doesn't have the relationships and the families and things to give people a good start in life. So the question then becomes, what should policy and what role should government have in dealing with it? I'd actually argue that lots of these problems originate from the sort of welfare states that we have already, and I fear that the message that's coming from the good right agenda is actually we need more state interference in this regard rather than actually taking the state away in some respects and actually, you know, reforming existing institutions.
I think we need a different state rather than more state. I think the housing market, I think, is the best example of this. At the moment, taxpayers spend £25 billion on housing benefit, picking up the pieces from a very broken housing market. Where I agree with Ryan is part of the solution to ensuring we have more houses so that the cost of housing comes down is we need planning reform. The Adam Smith Institute has said releasing just 1% of Greenbelt would produce enough houses for 10 years of increased supply, but I also think probably we need some government money to kickstart that house building revolution, some investment in infrastructure, some investment in more affordable housing, partly because we have an oligopolistic, I can't even say the word, a development construction sector at the moment which isn't equipped to build the kind of houses that the country needs. So from the minimum wage to changing the tax system so we tax luxury goods more and the income of poorer people less, to investing in house building, I want the state to be smaller overall, but I want it to do a few things better than it does at the moment.
So I don't want this to sound too much like a post-mortem, because obviously the election, we've still got a week or so to go as we're recording this, and David Cameron very much could still win. But as Tim said, Ryan, there's something gone wrong. That big, invasive offer isn't right. What do you think's wrong with the Conservatives offering to Britain at this election?
Well, I don't start from the point that I think a Conservative victory, whatever they say and whatever they promise, is ultimately a good thing. You know, I've worked for a think tank. You know, our broad position is that we think that we've got the right ideas for the country. I happen to think that actually Ed Miliband had a pretty good agenda when he outlined the cost of living crisis in 2012 and 2013. I think he identified that there are a range of essential products that have become too expensive for people on low incomes. And I think there was a real opportunity there for actually David Cameron and the Conservative Party to put forward a traditional market-based sort of Thatcherite agenda of supply-side reform in each of those areas, from housing to energy policy through to childcare, which would have actually lowered the cost of those essential items. And we wouldn't be having this debate about the living wage if they'd have done all of those things. So I think that they did miss an opportunity to have a sort of pro-poor agenda there. And I think I agree with Tim in certain regards. Lots of the policies that they've reached for, rather than doing that, have seemed like sort of Thatcherite reheats, rather than applying the principles of Thatcherism to today's challenges.
And I'm encouraged. Ryan and I have had a lot of discussions about the good right on Twitter in another fora. And actually, I think we are coming closer and closer as we realise he's improving my arguments. I hope I may have had some impact on him. And whatever happens, I think, in this election, of course, there will be differences, but I think the Conservative Party knows that its current offer, reheating Thatcherism from the 1980s, to use Ryan's expression, isn't enough. There has to be something of a real pro-poor, pro-mobility offering. Something there we Conservatives of the right are standing with people who don't always succeed as well as those who do succeed. Now, we're going to continue to discuss and debate precisely what that means in terms of policy, but at least the right is thinking about how to save capitalism from its weaknesses, thinking about how those who aren't benefiting from capitalism at the moment can it benefit more. The very fact that that discussion is happening gives me a lot of hope.
Absolutely. Well, and just finally, we obviously know what on Boris's agenda, if David Cameron doesn't win, he begins to line himself up to run for leader of the Conservative Party. But if David Cameron does win and is Prime Minister again, Tim, what do you think his agenda is going to be? Because we've sort of got little bits of policy, but it very much just seems continuation as we've known. And will that not just cause more problems for the Conservative Party if we have 5 years of the status quo?
I don't think we will have 5 years of the status quo. I think if David Cameron does survive as Prime Minister, he will be governing in coalition with the Liberal Democrats that will push him in certain direction. But he'll also be governing in coalition with Boris Johnson, Sajid Javid, Theresa May and the other people who will probably succeed him as leader. Now, each one of those, interestingly, you have Boris in your magazine this week arguing for a greater focus on inequality. And Theresa May, in a lecture that she gave to a Conservative home a few years ago, talked about a Conservatism much more for the cities and for urban Britain. Sajid Javid's whole personal story of social mobility is something that he wants to bring to the Conservative Party. So I think, you know, we aren't a presidential system, we are a parliamentary democracy. David Cameron won't be completely in charge of the Tory mission. It will be all of these people as well. And whether it's Ruth Davidson, Boris Johnson or these other, they're all pushing in the same direction.
I think Tim's right to a certain extent. I think just like the Republican Party in the US, the Conservative Party have got an interesting bench. There's a wide variety of different views and different ideas for how to take the country forward. And I suspect that that will be played out in quite a fiercely contested Conservative election debate. It wouldn't surprise me if up to as many as sort of 10 people put their names forward, and there will be a huge battle for the soul of the Conservative Party. But I'd say the promising thing from Tim's perspective is that I think Boris is looking for your endorsement, given his outpourings in this interview.
And finally, will it be illegal to criticise Islam after the election? In the magazine this week, Rod Little looks at Ed Miliband's statement that he will ban Islamophobia after the election and asks whether he'll be the first to leave the country. So Douglas Moore, you've also written on the Spectator's website about why this idea Ed Miliband has proposed of making Islamophobia illegal is stupid and also just wrong and it couldn't work. Can you explain why?
Well, yes, I mean, the first thing is it's obvious, simple vote pandering in the run-up to the election. Ed Miliband made these comments in an interview with a publication called Muslim News. He was clearly, as I say, trying to hawk for votes. But it's entirely unclear what he means. And I suggested in my blog that he should, apart from anything else, make clear what he means. If he wants to make it illegal to, for instance, beat up somebody or kill somebody because of their faith, well, that's already illegal. No one has any problems with that. Murder is illegal. Beating people up is illegal. Islamophobia, however, is a very, very nebulous concept. For instance, it would be deemed Islamophobic by a lot of Muslims to say things that are simply negative or critical about the founder, inventor of Islam. It's Islamophobic to a lot of people's minds to criticize or carry out historical inquiry into the origins of the Quran. In deigning to use this term Islamophobia, Ed Miliband has waded into this, and it's unclear to me at any rate if he knows what he's just waded into.
Exactly, because one of the points that you made in your blog is that defining exactly what Islamophobia is not an easy thing at all. But we do have other laws about religious discrimination, so wouldn't it be easy just to fit it into that?
Well, I my own view is that hate crime in general is not a good idea, that hate crime as a sort of super type of crime is a mistake, and that if somebody is beaten up because, you know, somebody wants to steal their wallet, it's as traumatizing as if they're beaten up because they're gay or any other reason, and that it's a mistaken law to have introduced this idea of these additional types of mega crimes, as it were. But yes, I mean, the problem, apart from anything else, by the way, I mean, there is a now, I think I've partly helped to win this argument, I thought, in recent years, of persuading people if they're going to talk about this area, they should talk about, for instance, anti-Muslim crimes. I mean, you know, I don't know, somebody trying to burn down a mosque or something like that. But the Islamophobia is so wrong as a term, partly, as I say, because of the fact that it seems to be as encompassing as to include anything that offends any Muslim at any one time, but also because, as I mentioned in my piece and Rod refers to, a phobia is an irrational fear. Now, the cartoonists at Charlie Hebdo were often called Islamophobic before two Islamist gunmen went into their offices and shot most of them in the head. Some people, as I've mentioned on my blog since, have been calling them Islamophobic since their murder. Now, if a phobia is an irrational fear, as a phobia is defined by the dictionary, were, and perhaps Edmund Rand can tell us this, were the journalists and cartoonists of Charlie Hebdo irrational to fear elements of Islam, or did it turn out to be a totally irrational thing to be fearful?
Well, because this, again, Rod talks about this in his column, that he mentions the Islamic Human Rights Commission. They name Charlie Hebdo as the Islamophobe of the year. So,
yes.
You know, yes. One has to ask that if Charlie Hebdo is in Britain under Ed Miliband, would that magazine be banned?
Oh yes, Charlie Hebdo wouldn't have been allowed to be published in the UK under the coalition either. I mean, perhaps it's worth pointing out that, I mean, you know, the Conservative and Liberal Democrat parties are not very good on this matter either. And don't forget that 10 years ago, the Blair government, only by one vote, was defeated from bringing in blasphemy laws in the UK in the wake of the 2005 London Underground bombs, another attempt to placate a certain portion of voters. So it's not an exclusive Labour problem, this. I mean, all the parties are bad on this. And yes, I think that Charlie Hebdo would have been at least chased out of this country under the current government as well. It's why it was sort of laughable seeing people like Nick Clegg and David Cameron saying "Je suis Charlie" after the murders in Paris. Of course, they weren't Charlie. If Charlie Hebdo had been published in this country, they would have done everything they could to shut it down and prosecute the publishers. We're not very good in this country, actually, on these matters. I do have one little thing to pick at Rod on, I must say. In his absence, I should use the opportunity to pick on him. Rod mentions that the Islamic Human Rights Commission, he doesn't add, of course, they're the so-called Islamic Human Rights Commission, a laughably mistitled organization, a Khomeinist front group. We don't need to look to the Ayatollah Khomeini for our moral inspiration, but the IHRC do. I have one other quibble with Rod in his column, which is he amusingly refers to my presumption in wanting to win Islamophobe of the Year, and seems to refer to me as a sort of lightweight in this category compared to himself. I would just add to that, though, I was once again on the shortlist this year of the Khomeinist organization's so-called Islamophobe of the Year. So I still do hold out the hope of one year, like Polly Toynbee, winning the award outright.
Yes, well, obviously Rod certainly enjoys saying this sort of thing in his column. And I think, just as finally, Douglas, it's interesting how these issues about religious freedom and what have you, given what happened to Charlie Hebdo, you know, no party really has a position on them apart from this one offhand comment by Ed Miliband. Do you see it as an issue that will appear again before the next election?
Do you know, all the time there are issues in our politics which dominate now the news agenda, and they're mostly sort of gossip, in my view. And elections like this, I think, bear that out. All the time there are huge, massive changes in our society and our culture which go almost unaddressed by our politicians. In fact, they don't just not address them, they steer clear of them, they try to avoid them. It's because issues like this are actually bigger than any one politician, they're bigger than any one political party. Perhaps they're bigger than any country to sort out now. I suspect our politicians realise that. they pander like this to communal groups. They pander to communal newspapers. They pander to so-called representatives of communities. But really, this seems to be beyond them now. What we want, I would argue, in this country is political leadership that says what it is that we expect from people in this country and doesn't do it in incredibly bland ways, such as David Cameron, Ed Miliband, Nick Clegg do, but actually makes it rather specific what Britain is, what we tolerate, what we don't. And to make it clear, as I've said again in a piece recently, that this country is very tolerant, but it's not tolerant of intolerant people. And that if you do want to come to this country and you want to believe that we don't have freedom of speech, then you should go away, leave. We don't want you.
And that's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much to our guests for joining, and thank you for listening.
The View from 22 was produced by Sebastian Payne. You can read all the articles discussed in this week's Spectator magazine, available in newsagents and on the Kindle and App Store. Subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find more episodes at spectator.co.uk/podcast.